Chapter 18. Since his grandmother wasn't just a senile, dangerous old coot, but also a racist, senile, dangerous old coot, Jazz had to do some advanced prep work before Connie could come over to the house. After giving it a lot of thought, he fell back on what Billy had once described to him as a poor man's sedative, to be used only when nothing else was at hand. He ground up some Benadryl in Grandma's soup and fed her dinner in front of the TV. It took only minutes for her head to droop, then go slack against the threadbare recliner that had been old since before Billy was born. Her spoon clattered into the bowl, and she nearly spilled the remaining soup all over herself, but Jazz, who'd been watching, darted in just in time and grabbed the bowl as it slipped from her liver-spotted hands. He checked her pulse. She was fine. She would sleep soundly for hours. He easily gathered her in his arms. Grandma was made up of skin and bones and hate and crazy don't weigh anything. He laid her out on the sofa, then called Howie with the all clear. Within 20 minutes, he was in his bedroom with Howie and Connie, Howie lounging at the desk, Connie sitting cross-legged on the bed, Jazz's head in her lap. "It's morbid," Connie said for the millionth time, referring to the victims on Jazz's wall. "It helped me figure out this guy's pattern," Jazz said. "That doesn't make it any less morbid."
"Morbid schmorbid," Howie chimed in. "It's just plain creepy."
He shot a rubber band and nailed victim number 27, Marsha Van Horn, between the eyes.
"Oops."
Jazz rubbed his eyes. A rubber band to the forehead was the least of Marsha's problems. "We need to figure this out," he said. "I need your help, guys."
"I aim to serve," Howie said, saluting.
Connie smoothed Jazz's hair back from his temples. "I, on the other hand, am here to tell you to chill out and forget all this nonsense."
"Can't forget it," Jazz said.
"Man's gotta do a man's work,"
Howie drawled in what was quite possibly the world's worst John Wayne impression.
"Gotta strap on those 6 guns and..."
"No one's carrying 6 guns. Jazz told him. He didn't even have to look over. He knew Howie's expression would be crestfallen. "But I need to do this. I need to prove that I can do more than just mess people up with what Billy taught me. I can do something good with it, too." Connie kissed his forehead. "Tanner's on the case. He caught your dad. He can catch a guy doing an impression of your dad." "G. William got lucky when he caught Billy," Jazz said. "He might not get lucky a second time. Besides, he's not 100% convinced this guy will follow Billy's pattern."
"What is the pattern?" Howie asked,
swiveling the chair and leaning forward to get a better look at the wall of victims.
"Victim numero 4-0.
"Quattro," said an exasperated Connie.
"Was Vanessa Dawes."
"Huh. VD. Venereal disease," he chortled.
"Crow up,"
Connie said. "She was an actress," Jazz said, ignoring both of them, staring at the ceiling. He didn't need to look into a file for information on any of Billy's victims. They were hammered straight into his memory banks for good. Came from Boise, Idaho,
home of the great potato,
and moved to New York when she was 19, Jazz went on, still ignoring Howie. "She was on a trip with friends, train hopping down the East Coast, when Billy met up with her. It was in a deli. She was ordering a corned beef sandwich." Jazz swallowed. Suddenly, it was like he was there, living it as Billy had described it. He remembered the dance of obscene light in his father's eyes as he'd told Jazz how he'd pretended to recognize Vanessa, then apologized profusely when he realized he didn't.
"He even said to her, 'You must think I'm some kind of crazy,' Billy had said. And she fell all over herself to tell me that wasn't the case. That she totally understood that she got that a lot."
"She was on some commercials," Jazz said now. "Nothing major, nothing national, all local and regional, but enough that Billy could get a good hook into her ego, get her thinking he was harmless. And then it was just a matter of offering to buy her a drink, getting her alone. And bang! 2 cc's of Drano, please, nurse,"
Howie! Connie punched the bed. People are dead!
Chastened, Howie swiveled the chair back to Jazz's desk and fiddled idly with the computer mouse. Billy had already killed a waitress in the same town. At that point, he stayed there for 3 weeks, killed Vanessa, then two more before skipping out.
So we think he's going to kill three more people in Lobo's Nod before moving on?
Jazz sat up, nodding. He stared at the wall, in particular at Vanessa Dawes. All of the copycat's victims have been identical to Billy's. Same occupations, same hair colors, same initials, same ages. So we're looking for someone in the Nod who has black hair, the initials VD, age 22.
Howie snorted again, then stopped, as if he could feel Connie's eyes blasting death rays into the back of his head.
The Nod isn't exactly Hollywood, Howie pointed out from the desk. It's not like there are a lot of actresses in this town. How would we find them, anyway?
What if he goes a little farther afield? Connie asked, her voice heavy and slightly hesitant with thought.
Jazz turned to her.
What are you thinking?
It might be nothing.
She looked from Jazz to Howie, who had spun around in the chair again.
It's probably...
Tell us.
Jazz gave her 1/10 of his sternest voice.
Real life, she said immediately. Over in Tynan Ridge, you know, actors go out there all the time.
The boys shook their heads almost in unison.
It's an acting school.
Some guy, can't remember his name, he used to be on that stupid TV show about the monkey that solved crimes.
Connie, Jazz said in the best move-along tone.
Anyway, he set up this acting school, does summer camps, stuff like that. My parents and I looked into it when we moved here, but it was too expensive. But he would have actresses from all over, including the Nod.
Jazz nodded. Yes, that made sense, but also...
What about the Crucible? Howie asked, reading Jazz's mind. There are actors right here in Lobo's Nod, too.
They're too young, still in high school, Jazz said. But age 22, maybe there's someone who used to be an actor in high school, but graduated, 4 or 5 years ago, and still lives in town. We'll have to check that out.
He hopped out of bed and started barking orders. Connie, you take Howie's car and go to real life. Check with this monkey actor guy and see if he has anyone enrolled who meets our criteria. You've been there before, so the guy will know you.
Howie and I will go to school and check the roster for the drama club and the plays from the last few years.
We should just call the sheriff, Connie said doubtfully. This is his territory, not ours.
Yeah, Howie said. And more important than that, why does she get to take my car?
Facing resistance from both of them, Jazz did the only thing he could think of. He paused for just a moment, pretending to weigh their thoughts. Then he started to speak, stopped, looked down at the floor as though ashamed.
Guys, he said hesitantly, wondering if the little hitch in his voice would work.
When he looked back up, they were both staring at him, rapt, enthralled, and he felt a sick, good flip-flop in his stomach. A job well done already, and he wasn't even halfway there.
This is really important to me,
he said, forcing his voice into a hushed whisper, as if he could barely speak without weeping.
You don't understand. G. William won't listen to us anyway. This way, we can get some solid evidence and present it to him. And maybe I can actually make the Dent name stand for something good and decent for a change.
He knew he had them when Connie put her arms around him. Moments later, they headed for the cars. Jazz wasn't proud of himself for manipulating his girlfriend and his best friend. No, wait. That wasn't entirely true. If he was being honest with himself, Jazz had to admit that there was a part of him that positively preened at how adroitly he'd gotten Connie and Howie to do what he wanted, what he needed. It was necessary, he told himself. They were holding him back, and the world was propelling him forward. He'd had no choice. Besides, it had been kind of fun, using that particular talent. There was no harm in that, right? Just a little adrenaline rush, a
glow of pure yes suffusing his whole being. He hadn't killed anyone. He hadn't done any harm to anyone. He accelerated, pushing the jeep faster down the road to the school. It was dark, and the streets of Lobo's Nod were practically empty. Jazz goosed the jeep to 6 miles over the speed limit. He knew from careful observation that the Lobo's Nod cops rarely bothered to pull anyone over unless they were doing 7 or more miles over the limit.
"Is this the right way to do it?" Howie asked.
"Like, is this how the real cops do things? Figure out who the victim is instead of who the killer is?"
"Sometimes that's all you have to go on," Jazz said.
"What if I already have a theory about who the killer is?"
Jazz smirked. "This should be good.
Go ahead." "I think it's that creep Weathers."
Jazz opened his mouth to tear apart Howie's theory. Then he shut it again.
"That," he said slowly, "isn't totally stupid."
"Gee, thanks. You do wonders for my self-esteem."
"He knows Billy's crimes. He would want the media to go nuts in the Nod again.
See? See?"
Jazz thought of Weathers and his ego. That he could be the killer was certainly more likely than Jazz's earlier rogue thought that G. William might be guilty. The memory of it made him squirm with guilt.
"It's possible," he admitted. "But our best bet is to find the next victim. That will lead us straight to this guy, whether he's Weathers or not."
Howie had his arm out the window, hand surfing the wind currents.
"I can't believe you talked me into this," Howie complained. "Actually, no, I take that back. I can totally believe you talked me into this. What I can't believe is that you talked Connie into this."
"Between the three of us, we're gonna figure this out," Jazz said. "This guy is done. He just doesn't know it yet."
"How many people did your pops kill?"
124, Jazz said, adding, as always, his mother to the official tally.
"And you think we're gonna stop this guy after 3?
"He wants to get caught. Billy once told me that most of these guys want to get caught. This guy is practically waving a white flag of surrender, man."
Howie snorted.
"If this works..."
"If this all works out, I'll get 2 tattoos, man."
Howie hooted and pumped his fist.
"Yes, Virginia! There is a Santa Claus!"
Jazz grinned and shook his head. "You're way too..." He broke off mid-word, staring straight ahead.
"Oh, crap," he said.
"Jazz!"
Howie screamed at the top of his lungs, and Jazz blinked and cranked the wheel left just in time to avoid a car peeling around a corner. He stomped on the brakes, and the jeep skidded to a halt in the middle of the intersection. The other car's horn blared loud and angry, dopplering into a whine as the driver accelerated ahead of them and out of sight.
"The light was red," Howie said. "Redder than red. Red like Christmas."
"Aw, man, look!"
He held out his right arm, bruised from where it had hit the side of the car.
"I missed it."
Jazz was surprised to find that his heart wasn't beating any faster, that his breath was perfectly normal. He had nearly slammed the jeep into the other car at top speed, and the result would not have been pretty. The jeep was too old to have airbags, so Jazz probably would have been wearing the steering wheel halfway through his chest, and Howie, well, the internal bleeding from jerking against the seatbelt probably would have done Howie in.
"Are you trying to kill us?"
"Virginia," Jazz said. "You said Virginia, right?"
"So what?" Howie ranted. "I didn't know the word offended you so much that you were going to try to..."
"We have to go." Jazz slammed his foot on the gas as he threw the jeep into reverse. Tires squealing, he spun the jeep around and then headed back the way they'd come.
"Where are you going? School is that way."
"I know. We're not going to school. We're going to Jenny's."
"Jenny's? You mean Miss Davis? Why are we going there?"
Jazz focused on the road, now breaking the speed limit by significantly more than 7 miles an hour. Howie wasn't stupid. He would figure it out.
"Oh, man," Howie said a moment later. "Jenny. Virginia Davis. And she's an actress with black hair.
I don't know how old she is, but she's right out of college.
I bet she's 22. Jazz said, leaning into the wheel, gripping it like a race car driver, throttling it like a throat.
What are you doing?
This last because Howie had fished his cell phone out of his pocket. Calling the sheriff, man. This is his department. Like, literally.
Jazz risked taking one hand off the wheel long enough to snatch away the phone.
Hey!
Howie complained. You call G. William, and one of two things will happen. One, he won't believe us, and we're right back at square one. Two, he'll totally believe us, and he'll send a million squad cars over, and that'll scare this guy off.
Isn't scaring this guy off a good thing?
Howie asked, reaching for the phone, but Jazz dropped it between his legs on the seat.
No.
We want to stay one step ahead of him, but he has to stay on the same path, get it?
So if he thinks we don't know about Jenny,
we get there, we ask her if she's noticed anything weird lately, like some guy following her around. If she has, then we tell G. William what we think, and he can put some undercover guys on her or something. If not, we can still ask her about any other actresses with her initials in town. Faster than breaking into school to check the records.
Ah, and now the reason you brought me instead of Connie becomes clear,
Howie grumbled.
Whenever it's illegal, there's good old Howie.
Jazz threw him a grin.
Your life would be so boring without me, and you know it.
Yeah, well, if you don't want to scare this guy off, you should probably slow down. If we careen into Miss Davis's parking lot like a bat out of hell, he's going to think something's up.
Good point. Jazz tapped the brakes, and by the time they'd gotten to Jenny's, the Jeep was moseying along like any other lazy car. Right after casting for The Crucible had been finalized, Jenny had invited the whole cast and crew to her apartment for an informal read-through and getting-to-know-one-another session. Jazz had lurked around the kitchen, uncomfortable being crammed into the tiny apartment with so many other kids. He'd watched Connie as she effortlessly flitted from one small cluster to another, and by the end of the night, he'd figured out how to mimic that behavior well enough to fit in. So the night had been a win for him, and now it was a double win because he knew exactly where she lived, a small three-story apartment building inserted like a mismatched Lego block between a dry cleaner and a car wash. He pulled into the parking lot and pointed through the windshield. Her car, he told Howie. She's home. He parked, scanned the area quickly. Nothing weird in the parking lot that he could see. No cars with out-of-state plates, no big vans or sedans that would make it easy to sneak a body away.
Let's get this done and over with,
Howie said with a nervousness that made Jazz want to laugh. Jazz handed Howie's cell over and killed the Jeep's engine. Let's go. Jenny lived on the third floor. There was no elevator. Howie beat Jazz by virtue of his ridiculously long legs, which ate up stairs three at a time.
I win,
he chortled, knocking on the door. What exactly did you win?
Bragging rights.
Jazz let it go. They waited for Jenny to come to the door. Nothing. She probably didn't hear you, Jazz said. Knock harder.
I bruise easy, Howie said, as if Jazz needed reminding.
Jazz gently pushed Howie out of the way and knocked on the door. Three quick, hard raps that couldn't be missed from inside.
Maybe she's not home.
Her car's in the parking lot. She... Wait. Jazz put his ear to the door.
What?
Shh! He waved Howie into silence, concentrating. From within the apartment, he heard something.
I hear.
Is she coming?
Jazz backed up, and his gaze drifted down to the keyhole. His stomach twisted. Was that a glimmer of reflected light he spotted? He leaned over and sniffed the doorknob, ignoring Howie, who wanted to know just what the hell he was doing. Glue. Filled with super glue.
You need some alone time?
Billy's voice whispered from the past.
You need some special, uninterrupted time? Well, then, you gotta make sure you can't be interrupted in the first place, you know what I mean? Block the doors. Block the windows. Make it so no one else can get in. And hey, bonus. When the cops come, they have to break in, and that makes a mess, and a mess is our friend, Jasper. Evidence gets lost in a mess. People get confused by messes.
Jazz's heart raced. A high-pitched whine filled his ears.
He's here, he whispered.
Chapter 19.
What?
Howie goggled at Jazz like a kid stuck on the Ferris wheel. Jazz grabbed Howie by the neck and pulled his friend's ear to his lips.
He's here.
Holy crap.
Run, Howie. Get outside. Call the cops. Watch for him by the fire escape out in the alley, in case he tries to get away.
Howie stared straight ahead, fear and shock flickering in his eyes. Jazz pushed him hard.
Go!
He whispered as loudly as he dared.
Now!
Howie ran like hell for the stairs. Jazz didn't think. He didn't allow himself to think. He'd heard the killer in there, he was sure. Maybe they weren't too late. His heart no longer raced. His breath came slow and easy, and the world seemed doused in syrup, everything moving lethargically. He had all the time in the world. In that strange, sudden fugue state, he backed up against the opposite side of the narrow corridor and lunged forward, kicking out with his right foot, catching the door at doorknob height, just the way Billy had taught him. The door trembled. A shockwave of pain vibrated up to Jazz's groin. It felt like he'd pounded a sledgehammer against his thigh, and all he had to show for it was a little bowing around the doorknob, and the unmistakable sound of rapid footfalls from within, as time returned to its normal flow, Jazz's heart thrumming like a timpani played by a spastic, his breath a harsh and hot wind in his throat.
"Don't you dare run!" Jazz yelled. "The cops are already surrounding the place!"
And then he pushed through the throbbing pain in his leg and lashed out again. He was surprised when the door burst inward, the knob and lock clanging to the floor. He ran, limping, as fast as he could, exploding into Jenny's entryway. The apartment was dark, but a rectangle of light spilled onto the floor halfway down a short hall. The living room, he remembered. Jazz made for it, spinning into the open archway that led into the living room. He barely had time to adjust to the light before the scene assaulted his eyes. The sofa he'd sat on with Connie, holding hands, now pushed against the wall under the window, tilted crazily askew from the rest of the room. A figure climbing atop it. Another, slight figure lying on a white and red patterned throw rug. The man on the sofa turned back. He wore a black ski mask, but that left the eyes open. Jazz's gaze met his for a bare second. Blue eyes. Crazy eyes. And then the killer turned away as though blasted with sunlight, one arm coming up to protect his face as he darted out the window. Jazz scrambled to the sofa, stopping when he felt the carpet squishing under his feet. The throw rug didn't have a white and red pattern. It was just white. He froze for a moment. He could still go through the window, maybe grab the killer, hold him until the police arrived. But Jenny. She was trembling on the throw rug, shaking as the fiber soaked up her blood, which jetted from the five clinical, almost surgical stumps on her right hand. Her eyes had rolled back in her head. He couldn't move. He was paralyzed, staring at her. This was it. This was the moment he'd heard so much about.
The moment Billy had apotheosized.
"People say there's a light goes out in their eyes when someone dies," Billy whispered in Jazz's mind, in his memory. "But that ain't all. There's a sound, Jasper. A sound that goes quiet. It's beautiful, and it's peaceful, and it's sacred and holy. You gotta get close to hear it go."
The telltale pinprick on her neck told the story, as if he needed the help. Like Meyerson had been, and like the next two victims would be, she'd been injected with drain cleaner, which had wreaked havoc on the muscles of her heart. As if the shock trauma of her fingers being cut off weren't enough, she was also in incredible pain and suffering a massive heart attack. Jazz prayed that Howie had called 911. He shook himself from his stupor and dropped to his knees next to Jenny. The sight and smell of the blood, the feel of it seeping through his jeans, made him dizzy. There was so much of it. You chop off five fingers while the victim's alive and struggling, and most likely you open up an artery or two.
First time I cut an artery, Billy said. I couldn't believe how much.
Jazz stopped the voice. He felt the blood. He wanted more of it. He wanted to run his hands through the carpet. He wanted none of it. He wanted to run. No, you can't run. Help her. You have to help her.
Did she recognize him? Or was she too far gone? He couldn't tell. Her expression was one of sheer panic, a terror that absorbed into every pore and every inch of flesh.
If she did recognize him, what was she thinking? Was she thinking?
Oh, thank God, it's Jasper.
Or, oh God, no, anyone but Jasper.
He felt like he should say something to her, but he didn't trust his voice. He didn't trust anything about himself.
All he wanted at that moment was to lean over, take her throat in his hands.
God! God damn it! God damn Billy Dent and God damn his son, too!
Tears sprang to Jazz's eyes. She was dying. Dying right in front of him. And he didn't trust himself to help her because he didn't trust his hands not to finish the job instead.
Just do it! He yelled to himself, his voice raw and bleak in the close quarters of the apartment.
Save her, you useless piece of... He didn't finish. As he watched, she hitched a breath, then gasped, then stopped breathing. She was in the full throes of cardiac arrest. Jazz didn't think. He didn't torture himself. He tilted her head back and listened for breathing, nothing. A moment of intense pleasure washed over him, followed by a revulsion so sickening that he almost threw himself headlong out the window.
Not yet. She's not dead yet.
With her head still tilted back, he pinched her nose shut and sealed his mouth over hers, exhaling hard into her until her chest rose, then again. She lay there, still. His fingers probed her chest until he found the xiphoid process. He started chest compressions, pumping 30 times, then rocking back on his heels. Nothing. He blew into her mouth again, her chest rising and falling for him, but then going still again when he switched back to compressions.
Don't do this, Jenny, he said to her. Don't give him this. Don't give me this.
Tears streamed down his face. He didn't know why. He didn't know if he was desperate to save her, or just angry at himself for even trying. A voice in his head. It wasn't Billy's. Jazz was afraid it was his own, whispered that if she died, at least he would be here for it. At least he would witness it. Breath, breath, and compressions. Breath, breath, and compressions. It felt like it went on forever. It felt like he'd aged years, grown old while trying to keep her alive, his arms and shoulders burning, his lips chapped and raw. The flow of blood from her fingers slowed and stopped. Clotting already? Or because the heart no longer beat to drive blood anywhere? He couldn't decide which. Didn't want to know which. Finally, he rocked back on his heels, still kneeling in her blood. She was gone. There was nothing he could do. She'd probably been dead for entire minutes now. And he felt... He didn't know. He didn't know what he felt. A part of him had dreaded this day, this moment when he would encounter his first fresh kill. He'd been afraid it would awaken something that slumbered fitfully within him. But he'd also anticipated it, yearned for it. It would, he knew, answer the question one way or another. Did he lust for death like his father before him? And yet here he was. Here he knelt, with a shattered, drained life before him. And nothing. He had tried to save her, hadn't he? Did that mean anything? But she wasn't his victim. Maybe he'd only tried because he had had no hand in her death. Or maybe he truly wanted her to live. He didn't know. He'd tried and failed. Had he tried hard enough? Had some part of him held back? Had he only done it so that he could touch her as she died? Everything he'd done seemed so loaded now, the motions of CPR taking on a tawdry, lurid tenor in his mind, his lips on hers, his hands on her chest, between those same breasts that had been compressed against his so recently. The silence was overpowering. Billy had been right. When she'd gone, some sound had gone with her. One moment, there'd been something of her, something along with his own hissing breath and his own grunts as he pounded at her still chest. And the next, that something was gone, dead, quiet. He listened to the silence. The emotions running through him made no sense. Fear, hope, grief, joy, lust. They weren't Billy Dent's feelings, but they weren't a normal person's either. What the hell am I? The silence ended as suddenly as it had begun. In the distance, sirens wailed, closing in. Howie had called 911 after all. How much time had passed since he'd sent Howie rushing outside? The killer had gotten out the window, but how far had he gone? Could he still be caught? Jazz leapt to his feet and scrambled over the sofa to the window. He looked down as the sirens grew louder. Down in the alley, a long, thin figure lay in a pool of widening blood, illuminated by the lights from the car wash. Howie. Chapter 20. Jazz didn't think. He hurled himself through the window and clambered down the fire escape like a monkey on crystal meth, dropping the last 6 feet to the dirty alley pavement the way the killer must have. How long had it been? How long had he struggled with Jenny? No sooner had his feet touched the ground than one of the sirens moaned to a halt, an ambulance jerking to a sudden stop right in front of him. Two paramedics practically fell out of the ambo, one carrying a black bag. Jazz got to Howie before they did. He was still breathing, lying face down on the asphalt. Where was all the blood coming from? He didn't want to move Howie and make it worse, but he had to know. In the background, he could still hear another siren, the police, pulling into the parking lot. Jenny lived, had lived, he reminded himself, closer to the hospital than to the police station. Howie, can you hear me? Howie, come on, man, Howie! Jumper, the first paramedic said, running over and checking the distance from the roof at the same time. What the hell? Call said third floor, but... There's no time, Jazz said, taking control. He's a type A hemophiliac. Hold on, kid, the second paramedic said. Our call said third floor. Is this the same? The woman on three is dead already, Jazz said, as composed as he could make himself, which was actually very, very composed. This one here is a type A hemophiliac. He needs... No bracelet, said the first one, already down on one knee next to Howie. The paramedic touched his neck. Pulse is thready. He needs clotting factor 8, Jazz said. He felt a wash in blood. Jenny's, now Howie's. The second paramedic, standing doubtfully aside, pointed to Jazz's pants. Is that your blood? What's going on here? Please. Howie had already lost a lot of blood, and he would lose more if these yahoos didn't get their acts together. 10 pints. 10 pints was all he had, and it gushed from him like a water cannon. As if to complicate things, a Lobo's Nod deputy came into the alleyway, barking into his shoulder mic, clearly communicating with another cop in the building. A moment later, another man followed. It was Deputy Erickson, out of uniform, dressed in jeans and a t-shirt. Great. Where the hell had he come from? Jazz shook it off. Howie was all that mattered. Please, just administer a dose of... Kid, this guy's got no medical bracelet and I'm not about to give him... He forgets it all the time, Jazz told them. By now, the second paramedic had decided that Jazz needed medical attention too, and was preparing to wrap a blood pressure cuff around his arm. Jazz shook him off. He forgets the bracelet, trust me. He's gonna bleed out if you don't. We know our jobs. Who the hell do you think you are, kid? And Jazz snapped. He didn't snap the way a normal person might snap. A normal person would fling his arms around and stomp his feet and rant at the top of his lungs, bellowing to the sky. There might be tears from a normal person. Jazz went quiet. He darted out one hand and grabbed the wrist of the paramedic who had been trying to cuff him and pulled the man close, holding his gaze. In a moment, he channeled every last drop of Billy Dent. Who am I? I'll tell you. I'm the local psychopath, and if you don't save my best friend's life,
I will hunt down everyone you've ever cared about in your life and make you watch while I do things to them that will have you begging me to kill them. That's who I am. It was ridiculous. It was absurd. And yet, it was utterly believable.
He left no doubt in the man's mind that Jazz could and would do exactly as he'd promised.
Moreover, he left no doubt that Jazz would enjoy every last second of it.
You,
the EMT swallowed.
You said type A?
Yes.
We don't have a clotting factor 8 on the bus, but we can give him DDAVP to hold him until we get to the hospital.
Then do it, Jazz ordered, shoving the paramedic away from him. Erickson, who had watched the whole thing, stood stunned for a moment, then approached Jazz and, without preamble, slapped handcuffs on him.
Chapter 21. Erickson shoved Jazz against the wall and started reading him his rights. As much as Jazz didn't like Erickson, he really couldn't blame the deputy. Jazz had threatened the paramedic, and the other cops on the scene were reporting over their mics that the third-floor apartment's door was kicked in, the window was open, and there was a dead woman on the floor. Jazz probably would have brought out the cuffs, too, if their positions had been flipped.
"Do you understand these rights?" Erickson asked as he finished.
"Well?"
"Sure I do." "Hey, do you always carry handcuffs when you're off duty?" Jazz taunted. "Your girlfriend's like that?"
"Shut up,"
Erickson said, frisking Jazz quickly but efficiently. Jazz stood mute as the deputy ran his hands up between his thighs. Howie would have had a smart-ass zinger ready. Jazz couldn't think of a single one. Erickson spun him around, and Jazz made a point of looking at the deputy's eyes. Blue. Were they the same blue as the killer's? Jazz couldn't be sure. The lighting here in the alley was so different from the light in Ginny's apartment. He could hear G. William now.
"Eye color ain't exactly evidence, Jazz."
"Take a picture," Erickson growled as Jazz stared. "It'll last longer." "Just happened to be in the area while off duty, Erickson?" Jazz said sarcastically. "Like when you were the first one there to see Carla O'Donnelly and Helen Meyerson."
"I don't know what you're getting at, kid. I live 2 blocks away."
"What am I under arrest for?" Jazz asked. Behind Erickson, he could see the paramedics lifting Howie on a stretcher. An IV bag had already been hung. They were moving quickly, speaking in short, clipped sentences composed mostly of numbers and abbreviations. Howie's stats. Howie's meds. Howie's life. Reduced to medical jargon.
"Pretty much anything I can think of," Erickson said.
He gestured to another deputy, who had come back into the alleyway.
"Take this kid to the station. I'll be along soon."
"What's the charge?"
the other deputy asked.
"Yeah, I was just wondering the same thing," Jazz put in.
"Shut up," Erickson said again. "The charge right now is suspicion of being a pain in my ass. I'll put something formal down when I get to the station. For now, just get him out of my sight."
"Wait!"
Jazz shouted.
"Look, don't take me away yet. Let me go to the hospital with Howie."
"Are you nuts? For all I know, you're the one who killed him."
"Killed him?
He's not. Get him out of here," Erickson said.
Jazz struggled as the deputy dragged him away. He heard the ambulance door slam, and then the ambulance engine revved. The siren wailed. Good. If Howie were dead, then they wouldn't be bothering with the siren. Pulled out of the alley and into the parking lot of Ginny's building, Jazz saw his night go from miserable to nightmarish. Standing there in the parking lot was none other than Doug Weathers. What was he doing there? It took Weathers a moment to realize what was happening, but Jazz could see the calculation in his eyes as he began to understand what was unfolding before him. Jazz in cuffs, police on the scene, ambulance roaring past. It all equaled a major story to Weathers, a story that could easily be grafted to the Billy Dent story and once again have CNN and the networks pointing their satellites at Doug Weathers. Weathers quickly fumbled in his pocket and brought out his cell phone, raised it to eye level. Oh, great. He was going to take a picture as soon as Jazz got close enough. Jazz couldn't let that happen.
"Hey, Jasper," Weathers called out naked glee in his voice. Smile! Before Weathers could do anything, Jazz dropped his head and charged, breaking free from the deputy. His hands were cuffed behind him, so he collided with Weathers, his shoulder digging into the reporter's gut, knocking him off kilter and sending the cell phone to the ground. The deputy shouted out from behind him, but Jazz just barreled ahead. Weathers fell backward and landed on his butt. Jazz staggered to one side, stepping on the cell phone with a satisfying crack. Just to be sure, he ground his foot down hard. Plastic crunched.
Hey! Weathers shouted, jumping up. Hey, you can't do that!
The deputy grabbed Jazz and pulled him away. The phone looked like someone had stepped on an enormous high-tech cockroach, its wiry guts shooting out from the broken case.
You son of a—
Weathers got up in Jazz's face.
You just destroyed private property, kid. I'm gonna sue you. I'm gonna have you arrested for malicious—
Already arrested, Jazz said calmly. And hey, you can't sue me for being clumsy.
Clumsy!
Weathers' eyes went so wide that Jazz wondered if the man's sockets could hold them in.
Clumsy? You charged me!
Nah, I tripped, man. I'm such a klutz. Sorry. I'll buy you a new cell. Weathers lunged for Jazz, who tried to sidestep but found himself stuck between the reporter and the deputy. Jazz grunted as Weathers landed a weak blow on his shoulder.
You gonna arrest this guy for battery? Jazz asked the deputy.
Ah, jeez. The deputy muttered as Weathers flailed again. This time, all three of them went down in a heap. Jazz winced as he landed on his side.
Clumsy! Weathers ranted. Oh, clumsy you, you little—
And then Erickson came running up, shouting. He waded into the fray, pulling Weathers off of Jazz, pushing Jazz to one side to free up the other deputy. He moved with ruthless efficiency and quiet strength, easily shoving Weathers aside as if the man weighed no more than a bag of sugar. Jazz kicked and shimmied a little to make Erickson's job tougher. Suddenly, bright headlights stabbed at him. He couldn't shield his eyes with his hands, so he had to close them instead, sinking into the bright red world behind his eyelids. The car stopped nearby. A door opened. A voice said,
"What the hell is going on here?"
Jazz had never been so glad to hear G. Williams' voice. Jazz's wrist still hurt a half hour later at the hospital. Erickson had put the cuffs on way too tight. With the cuffs off now, he sat in the waiting room at Lobo's Nod General Hospital, alternating between wrists, rubbing them back to life. G. William had immediately demanded a report from Erickson, who ran down what he knew, including that Howie was on his way to the hospital. G. William had taken in the scene, including a beyond irate Doug Weathers, and ordered Erickson to secure the area while he took Jazz to the hospital. Jazz spoke little to G. William on the way to the hospital. A part of him, some intuitive quiet part, wanted to warn G. William not to trust Erickson with the crime scene. But the larger part of him was worried about Howie. He was afraid that getting into an argument with the sheriff would delay his getting to the hospital. Howie was still in surgery when Jazz arrived. Once G. William was done with the crime scene at Jenny's, the sheriff would, Jazz knew, unload a world of hurt on Jazz for interfering. Worse yet, once Howie's parents returned from filling out the insurance forms, they were going to unload their own particular brand of hurt on him. Howie's mom had never approved of her son hanging out with Jazz, and she would never, ever let him forget this, even if Howie lived. The door whispered open, and Connie ran in, out of breath, her braids flying behind her. She launched herself into Jazz's arms as he rose from his chair.
What happened? Are you okay? Is Howie okay? What happened?
She'd been halfway to Tynan Ridge when Jazz, borrowing G. William's cell for a moment, had texted her to tell her to get to the hospital. He gave her a truncated version of events. Jenny, the killer, Howie. Looks like he was cut when he intercepted the guy in the alley, Jazz finished. And then...
Jenny? Jenny's dead?
Connie went weak in his arms, and it took all his strength to keep her from collapsing to the floor and guide her to the chair he'd just abandoned. He maneuvered her into it.
I'm really sorry, he said. It was...
Connie started sobbing, heaving, violent sobs that racked her body. Jazz stood before her, baffled, unsure what to do.
In movies and books, the man always puts his arms around the crying woman, but he never understood what that was supposed to accomplish, and he couldn't see it now either. Still, it usually worked, so he bent over and folded Connie into his embrace, where her crying became muffled, the rhythm of it a strange and sour chorus to the beating of his heart. "It'll be okay," he said, feeling like an idiot for saying it. It would not be okay. It would most emphatically not be okay. Jenny was dead. Howie was in surgery. Worst of all, the killer was still at large. It was the exact opposite of okay. Just then, the door hissed again, in that peculiar sibilance reserved for hospital doors. Howie's parents stumbled into the waiting room as though they'd both been shot. Mr. Gersten's face was as ashen as Howie's had been in the alleyway. Jazz couldn't see Mrs. Gersten's face, which was buried against her husband's shoulder. "Should we?" Connie started, then stopped herself, remembering no doubt that Howie's parents had never liked Jazz much to begin with. The Gerstens made their way to a sofa and collapsed onto it like some bizarre conjoined twins. Overhead, a voice said, "Dr. McDowell to oncology? Dr. McDowell, oncology?" And when it went away, the air was populated only with the stereo effect of two people weeping.
"What if he doesn't?" Mrs. Gersten said.
"Shh, he will. He's strong," her husband answered in what Jazz thought was the least convincing tone of voice in history.
"He's not strong," she yelled. "He's the opposite of strong. He can't even..."
And then she lost all her words and just wept and wept. Jazz forced himself not to look away, and Mr. Gersten met his eyes. A moment passed between them, as if they were respecting each other and their strangely male stoic roles in this drama. But then, Mr. Gersten broke down too, and tears streamed down his face.
"And now it happens," Jazz murmured, figuring that this would be the moment where Mr. Gersten would come over and abuse him, verbally at the very least, but physically would be completely understandable. But the Gerstens didn't move, didn't speak, didn't glare. Not even when Mrs. Gersten finally looked up from her husband's shoulder to reveal eyes bloodshot like a road map.
Relatively sure he wouldn't be assaulted, Jazz steered Connie to a largish chair and they both settled into it. "You ready to hear what happened?" he asked in a soft voice that would not cut through the church-like quiet of the waiting room. Connie wiped her eyes and nodded. "This isn't going to be easy to hear," Jazz told her, already editing events in his mind. Connie didn't need to know all of it.
"We remembered Jenny's real name was Virginia, making her a perfect match for the next victim," Jazz started, and then told her what had happened after that, leaving out the most gruesome details of Jenny's death and his own complicated reaction to it.
Time in the waiting room had no real meaning. Even though Jazz was sure he must have spoken to Connie for hours, he was convinced no time had passed at all. Eventually, though, a doctor emerged through a different whispering, hissing door and approached the Gerstens.
"Mr. and Mrs. Gersten, I'm Dr. Mogiloff. I'm the trauma surgeon who saw your son."
Jazz felt Connie stiffen next to him, but the doctor's body language and tone of voice told Jazz everything he needed to know even before she said it.
"Your son came through surgery much, much better than we would have expected. Given his condition and the amount of trauma, he's really in phenomenal shape, I think."
She got no further. Mrs. Gersten collapsed against her husband, her tears now of joy. Mr. Gersten pumped the doctor's hand enthusiastically, and the surgeon's reserve cracked into a broad and relieved smile.
"He's in recovery right now, and he needs to be alone while he sleeps, but he's going to be okay. He's going to live."
Connie sighed with a relief as the Gersten sank into the couch again. For Jazz, it was as though he'd been trapped underwater in a frozen lake, frantically swimming back and forth, pounding on the thick ice above, looking for a break, for a hole. Able to see the sunlight filtering through the ice, able to see the open air, but unable to breathe it. The air in his lungs already run out, his life measured not even in seconds,
but an instance of no determinate length, when suddenly, just as the black of the water and the black of his own death had wrapped their tendrils around him and threatened to squeeze the last bits of life out of him, his questing hands found a break above, and he launched himself through it and opened his mouth to the sweet, sweet. Jazz dropped into a hard, sudden sleep in Connie's arms.
A hand gently nudged Jazz from a deep slumber.
Gotta wakey-wakey, Jasper, my boy.
And he startled, waking Connie, who had drifted off with him. The Gerstens were nowhere to be seen, and G. William stood over him.
You hearin' me, Jazz? You awake?
Jazz grumbled, sitting up and wiping an embarrassing string of drool from his chin. It hadn't been the usual dream, with the knife. It had been rusty this time. He blinked bleary sleep away.
Got a wakey. I'm awake.
Is Howie?
He's up, in the ICU. Dr. Mogiloff says no visitors tonight, but she's making an exception, given the circumstances. Need to talk to the two of you, put together some kind of timeline for what happened tonight.
G. William checked his watch.
Last night, technically.
Connie disentangled herself from Jazz and stood up.
Let's go.
Sorry, G. William seemed genuinely apologetic. Family only back there. I got a need for Jazz police business, but they won't let you in. Maybe tomorrow.
Connie took that as well as she usually took someone telling her what she couldn't do. She crossed her arms over her chest and cocked her left hip in what she called her sassy stance and fixed the sheriff with a glare that Jazz knew all too well. He leapt up between them before Connie could start a fight.
Con, it'll be okay. You should go home, get some real rest. We'll both come back tomorrow to see Howie together, okay?
He's my friend, too, she said, her jaw set, her eyes flashing with anger.
I know.
He hugged her, even though she didn't open her arms to him. He held her until she thawed, pecking him on the cheek and leaving without so much as a kind look in the sheriff's direction. G. William adjusted his hat and grinned.
That one will keep you on the straight and narrow, Jasper Francis. Don't let her go.
He clapped a hand on Jazz's shoulder and guided him through a door and down a corridor. The hospital was quiet, even the footfalls of nurses muffled by the gummy soles of their shoes. Jazz felt like he was walking down a dream hallway, where sounds were not allowed to exist. Sounds and, maybe, the living. Breaking the unnerving silence, he said, I have to ask, this may seem stupid, but Jenny, Ms. Davis, is she really?
Sorry, Jazz. I know you tried your best, but yeah.
Okay. I thought there was a chance maybe that I was wrong, that I didn't read her pulse right, or
put your fingers right here. And make sure, Jasper, make damn sure. Because the last thing you want is what's supposed to be a corpse getting up and telling the world what you done.
There was no chance. Of course not. But he'd hoped.
I want to wrap this up fast, G. William said, moving. I bet you're worried about your grandmom, and I want to get you home to her.
Grandma. In all the craziness, he'd forgotten about her, had completely lost track of time. He wasn't even sure what day it was or what year. Time had gone elastic and malleable and ductile. Nighttime was the worst time of the day for Grandma, but the Benadryl should have kept her knocked out. He hated imagining what she would do if she woke up alone. Anything was possible, really, up to and including deciding that he'd been abducted and launching her own version of a commando raid on the nearest house. Well, there was nothing to do about it for now. He had to help G. William and then,
here we are.
G. William said, gesturing to a door. Somehow it wasn't fair. Beyond that door lay Jazz's best friend in the world, the best friend he'd put in harm's way, the best friend he had nearly killed as easily as if he'd wielded the knife himself. And yet the door looked like every other door along the corridor. There was nothing special about it, and there should have been.
You ready for this?
G. William asked. Jazz wasn't, but he nodded anyway, and G. William pushed open the door. It wasn't nearly as bad as Jazz had feared. That said, it was still bad enough.
If I didn't have bad luck, I wouldn't have any luck at all, Howie said as soon as he saw Jazz, cracking a grin.
It was Howie, and it wasn't Howie, all at once. His best friend lay in a hospital bed, covered to the chest with a blanket so faded blue that it was almost white. Stick thin, Howie looked even thinner under that blanket, a series of long wrinkles in the fabric that suggested a body more than revealed one. His skin was sallow, his eyes sunken above massive bags that drooped down like twin black eyes with something to prove. Bruises ran up and down both arms, radiating out from the points where tubes entered his body. The tubes. There were, Jazz counted, three of them. A saline drip for hydration, a line still transfusing blood, and a third one. Something else.
Dinner time, Howie joked, pointing to one bag, as if he could read Jazz's confusion over the air like a radio transmission.
Dextrose, right. It had been hours since Howie had eaten, and he probably still wasn't up to taking solid food, what with the trauma, the anesthetics. A duo of wires also hung limp between connection points on Howie's chest and a heart monitor beside the bed. The monitor's EKG line loped along at a steady, slow 60 beats per minute. Tolerable.
Apparently, Howie said jovially, he missed every vital organ and only nicked a blood vessel. You probably would have gotten up and chased the guy down. Me? I end up face down in my own blood. Three cheers for low clotting factor. Next time you get to be the one who gets stabbed.
You weren't stabbed, Jazz said after a moment's hesitation. You were slashed. They're different.
Okay, whatever.
Howie grimaced as he adjusted his position in bed. Can we at least do some CSI mojo on my wound and figure out what kind of knife he used and then, like, track him down where he bought it and totally go SWAT style on his ass? G. William answered before Jazz could.
Doesn't work like that. Sorry. Slashing wounds don't, betray any characteristic of the blade. Only stab wounds do that. If he'd stabbed you instead of slashing you, then maybe we could get some kind of forensic.
G. William realized he was rambling and drifted off into silence, clearing his throat. He settled into a chair next to the bed.
Anyway, the docs are saying you're going to be fine. Glad to hear it.
Jazz still lingered by the door, unable to move closer. A crashing wave of guilt had broken over him as soon as he recognized Howie in the bed, and the force of that wave kept him from approaching. Guilt. This kind of guilt, at least, was unfamiliar to him. Guilt for manipulating people? Sure. All the time. But he dismissed that guilt as a matter of course, as a cost of doing business. This was different. He'd almost gotten someone killed. He had gotten someone killed. Howie raised a hand, even though it clearly took effort, and waved for Jazz to come closer.
You gonna guard the door all night? Don't you want to see my stitches? They're gross.
He said gross with a whisper of delight. Jazz went to the bed and stood opposite G. William. He had a powerful urge to touch Howie, almost to prove to himself that this paper-thin, transparent-skinned thing in bed was really his best friend and not a hallucination. Howie leaned as close as he could, given his weakness in the tubes. His voice, already weak, wasn't getting any stronger as he spoke.
I have to own up, dog. You can't see the stitches yet. They're still taped and gauzed.
Jazz played along. Are you going to have a scar? Howie frowned.
A little one. I wanted a nice big one, but no one asked me, on account of me being unconscious at the time. Can you believe it?
Bastards, Jazz intoned. And then he did it. He reached out and put his hand over Howie's where it lay on top of the blanket. Something in that connection, something in that completed circuit, the taut vulnerability of Howie's skin, the reality of contact, something, shattered a vessel deep inside Jazz, and he found himself speaking before he could think. It's all my fault, he whispered. It's my fault she's dead.
It's not. It is. You wanted to call G. William from the car. If we had... Howie's voice floated from the bed, weak but resolved. It would have gone down the same. Homeboy was already killing her.
Howie's right, Jazz,
G. William said gently. He rubbed his battered mass of a nose.
If you'd called, we wouldn't have gotten there any faster. And in the meantime, you made him deviate from his plan. You interrupted him, scared him. He usually cuts the fingers off post-mortem. This time, he cut them off while she was still alive.
Oh, yay. The bitterness lay heavy on Jazz's tongue. A victory for us. I'm sure Ginny will be glad to hear. Oh, wait, that's right, she's dead. G. William gave him a moment to indulge his anger and guilt, then cleared his throat.
I need to know exactly what you guys did and saw. Gonna record this, okay?
He brandished his smartphone and aimed the camera at them. They consented to being recorded, and Jazz pulled up a chair, sinking into it next to Howie, leaving one hand brushing against Howie's, as if to make sure his friend wasn't going anywhere. Between the two of them, they recounted the logic that had taken them to Jenny's apartment and what had happened afterward. Jazz surprised himself by recalling and describing Jenny's death in a voice entirely devoid of emotion, and as he recited the facts, he found those same facts bothering him less and less. Grief was replaced with anger, anger at himself for failing, but also anger at the man impersonating his father.
Called 911, Howie was saying, and then I heard something in the alleyway, so I went back there and...
Howie coughed.
And valiantly attacked his knife with my guts to no avail. Did you get a good look at him? Could you describe him?
Howie smiled wanly.
Yeah, he was about yay long.
He held up his hands 4 inches apart.
Thin, made of steel, pointy, sharp.
Jazz grinned despite himself.
What about you, Jasper?
Jazz shook his head. He'd been trying to recall the killer's face, his eyes, anything, but he'd had only that single instant before the man vanished through the window, heading for street level and Howie's gut. Those blue eyes.
All I can tell you is he's white, which I think we already assumed.
Probably between 5'11 and 6'1-ish, he waggled a hand. Blue eyes. G. William thanked them and stood to leave, gesturing to Jazz that it was time for Howie to get some rest. But Jazz had to know. Did you guys find props in her apartment? The sheriff hesitated, then nodded.
Yeah, a toy bow and arrow and some other stuff. You know.
During his phase as the artist, Billy had posed his victims. For his fourth victim, he'd posed her like Cupid, drawing a bow, matching her initials, VD, to Valentine's Day. Billy's first dozen or so killings had all taken place before Jazz was born, so he didn't know why Billy had done this. Probably one more in a highly successful string of distracting tactics that had kept the cops off his trail for decades.
So I was right, Jazz said.
Looks like it. Definitely mimicking Billy's career.
What about the fingers?
Cut 'em, pre-mortem, not post. But you knew that already. We're not assuming this is a change in M.O., just that he heard you guys coming and had to move quickly.
Quickly. No more than a minute had passed between Jazz pounding on and then crashing through the door. The impressionist had cut off Jenny's fingers in record time.
Left the middle finger, as per usual. We found it under the sofa.
Jazz wondered if he'd kicked it there when running into the room.
You know what you have to do.
He stared at G. William and did not let up. The sheriff didn't even need to consult his smartphone.
Billy's next victim was named Isabella Hernandez, maid at a hotel. 35. First thing in the morning, my crew is contacting every hotel in the area and asking if they have anyone with the initials IH working for them.
Morning? What about now?
If he's following Billy's pattern, we have 3 days before he takes his next victim. Better to let my people go at it in the light of day.
What about the victims after her? You have the whole chronology of Billy's career. You can start looking for all of them, not just the next one. G. William shook his head.
Jazz, I can't do it that way. Have to put all of my manpower on the most imminent threat.
He held up a hand to stop Jazz before he could interrupt.
How would you feel if your wife was the next victim and she got killed and then you found out that the cops hadn't put all their efforts into protecting her?
Good point. What about the feds? You have to be getting them involved, right? G. William snorted.
Not just yet. Still putting together the VICAP report.
Quickly, before Jazz could jump in, he added,
That thing's 13 pages long, Jazz. 180-some questions to answer. And it ain't worth doing if we don't do it right. And right now, there's nothing convincing. Right now, it's just a pattern, but there's no M.O., no signature that's common.
The pattern is the signature. Jazz was up and out of his chair.
God, G. William!
Jazz, everything's inconclusive right now. I've made some calls to the feds on the QT, but the first murder just didn't have enough unique characteristics.
A severed finger isn't a...
Hey, guys. They broke off and looked down at Howie, who lay exhausted and weary between them.
You guys are totally harsh in the killer buzz I've been working on thanks to some amazing meds a very nice nurse gave me. It's bumming me out.
He grinned lazily.
And I'm not going to last much longer anyway. Sleepy time is totally strong-arming me. Sorry.
G. William cleared his throat with a sound like a drowning child.
We'll let you get some rest.
He jerked his head toward the door in a manner that tolerated no rebellion.
Hang on. Wait a sec,
Howie said. Jazz turned back to the bed. Howie gestured him over. G. William went out into the hall, and Jazz stood by Howie.
You need something? He asked him. More meds? Some water? A hot nurse and a stripper pole?
Howie chuckled, then winced.
Don't make me laugh. And I'll take that nurse and stripper pole in, like, a week. But here, I wanted to give you this.
He fumbled with the nightstand drawer for a moment, then handed his cell phone over to Jazz.
I'm not going to need it for a little while, so you might as well have it.
Thanks. Jazz stared at the thing, but, Howie gripped Jazz's wrist with all his strength, which wasn't much. It was like a baby's clench, if a baby had had Howie's absurdly long fingers. Still, the fact that Howie made the effort and the urgency in his eyes corralled Jazz's attention.
Get this guy, Howie whispered with all that was left in him. You'll need a cell when you're tracking him down. Take it.
Howie, man, I'm done. You heard G. William. He's got it under control. He's on it.
G. William isn't you, man.
You're the guy. You're the one.
No.
Do it for me. Howie, I'm out. Seriously. This was too much. You almost...
He yanked his hand away. I'm done.
You think?
Howie swallowed hard. It seemed to take forever.
You think you need to stop because I have some stitches? Lost some blood?
He forced the phone back into Jazz's hands as though his life depended on it.
Man, that's why you have to...
A long, slow blink.
That's why you have to,
he giggled.
Wow. This is some really good...
Bang. He was out.
Jazz took a deep breath, patted his best friend's hand,
tucked the cell phone into his pocket, and left. Chapter 22 Connie still had Howie's car and had driven home with it, leaving Jazz stranded, the Jeep abandoned in Ginny's parking lot. G. William drove Jazz there, even though Ginny's apartment building was the very last thing in the world Jazz wanted to see. From the street, you couldn't even tell anything had happened. There were two cruisers parked in the lot, but they had their lights out and engines off. They could have been two cops on patrol stopping to gossip or swap donut recipes. Down in the alley, he caught an occasional glimpse of a flashlight played along the walls. Crime scene investigating to see if the killer had left any evidence. Footprints, maybe. Maybe he dropped the knife he'd used to... Well, in any event, they'd be looking for evidence. A part of Jazz yearned to join them, but he had told Howie he was done, and he meant it. He was out of the profiling business. It had been abstract and compelling and, in a way, he had to admit, fun, when it had been Jane Doe. But Ginny died under his own hands. He had probably pushed her last breath out of her lungs. And Howie could have died so easily that...
You all right?
G. William asked. Jazz hesitated. He was out of the profiling business, true, but a part of him still felt compelled to help, as though the cops could never do this on their own. But who was he to think he could crack this case? Profiling was an art, not a science, sure. He thought he had some insight into the killer, but way back in 2002, the cops thought they had insight into the Beltway sniper, too. They knew the guy was white, young, childless. So, imagine their surprise when they caught John Allen Muhammad, black, 40s, with a kid close to Jazz's age in tow.
Jazz? I asked if...
Yep, he said, making a split-second decision. I'm fine. Thanks for the ride. He drove home a little faster than the law would favor. Now that he knew Howie was all right, he had to shift gears to the other person in his life who needed him, Grandma. He'd left her for, quick check of the in-dash clock, oh, Lord, more hours than he cared to imagine. He was worried she'd done something stupid, hurt herself, hurt someone else, done something that would make it easier for Melissa to yank him into foster care. Even if the Benadryl hadn't worn off yet, she could have rolled off the sofa and broken something. The house was quiet and dark when he unlocked the front door. He usually left a light on so that Grandma wouldn't trip in the dark, but he'd forgotten when he and Connie and Howie had left the house a million years ago. He paused in the foyer for a moment, listening to the careful click of the lock as he shut the door. Something cold lingered in the air, something that set him on edge. He had the feeling he was being watched, that someone was in the house. Well, of course someone's in the house. Grandma's in the... He didn't even finish the thought. Absurd. Trying to rationalize away the fear. Fear's okay, Billy had said to him once. It had surprised Jazz, who had always heard his father speak of fear as comedic, as something prospects evinced in a desperate, useless attempt to stay alive. Fear was something to laugh at in all its many splendid forms, each one unique to the victim. Fear can keep you alive. The trick is not to let it overwhelm you, not to let it rule you. If you're afraid, that's the universe trying to tell you something. Get away. Don't run. Don't panic. Just pick up and walk out. Calm as you please. Panic makes you stupid. Should he call G. William? After all, he had Howie's cell, an unfamiliar but comforting brick in his pocket. No, that was ridiculous. There was no one in the house. He crept into the sitting room. Grandma slept on the sofa, her breath a light snoring buzz. He sneaked closer to her and realized that she was covered with a blanket. She hadn't been under a blanket when he'd left. He turned slowly, his eyes adjusting to the dark, peering into the murk of the room. Empty. She might have covered herself. The blanket was from the chair a couple of feet away. She might have just gotten up, cold, groggily snatched up the blanket and wrapped herself in it before succumbing to sleep again. No one is in the house. It's just your nerves. After everything you've been through tonight, you're entitled. He grinned. Here he was, son of the world's most notorious serial killer, afraid of the dark. What was next? The boogeyman? The monster in the closet? Gremlins under the bed?